About Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This particular portion of the book of Daniel was written in the Syriac or the Aramaic language, and we have the names given in their Babylonian form. When these boys were taken away from their home at the probable age of 12 to 14, taken away from their home in Judea, their names were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But their names changed when everything else in their life changed. Taken away from their home, from their family, from every familiar environment, they were taken into the capital of the world, probably castrated, and their names changed, everything about their lives changed, along with their friend Daniel, who had his name changed to Belteshazzar. Daniel's name is mentioned 65 times in this book. Belteshazzar is mentioned 10 times. But Daniel is not in this chapter. This chapter is about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. All of their Hebrew names had a link to the one true and living Hebrew God. But their Babylonian names each had a link to a false Babylonian God. And every time they heard their Babylonian name, they could think of how much things had changed. After this chapter, we don't hear of these three men anymore. And I've wondered why Daniel's not in this chapter. You may have wondered the same thing. The only hint I have about that is that at the end of chapter 2, because of Daniel's retrieval and interpretation of the king's dream, back at that time, dreams were sometimes used by God to convey information. That was part of the sundry times and the divers manners that God used to communicate. Dreams today are not information from God. God now speaks to us through his completed word. Probably dreams today are more indicative of indigestion than of inspiration. But at the end of chapter 2, because of what Daniel had done, he was given tremendous responsibility as well as some authority. And I've wondered if the reason that Daniel is not mentioned in this chapter is because he was out of town on the business of the king. I don't know that, but since he doesn't show up here and is so prominent elsewhere, that seems like a possibility. Probably just gone away from home during the events of chapter 3. However that may be, we just don't hear of him here. Now, there are two main themes in this chapter. One of them is idolatry, and the other is suffering. I'd like to talk about each of those for just a moment. The idolatry comes into play all through the chapter, of course. Man is incurably religious, and man is always going to bow at some shrine, either literally or in his heart. He will bow at some shrine. This is indicated in the first chapter of the Roman letter. When you exchange the worship of God, you trade it in for something else. You don't just not worship. You worship something else or somebody else, even if it's just yourself. Man makes the kind of a God that he wants, and then he becomes more like that God every time he worships that God. Men make gods that accommodate the sinfulness in their own lives. Gods reflect the sinfulness of the men who invent them. So idolatry is an abandonment to an immoral standard. That's why often in the Bible it is called a whoring. Idolatry is maybe the most basic issue that God is concerned about. I say that because in the 20th chapter of Exodus, when we have the Ten Commandments given, the very first two of those are about this issue. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. They deal with the issue of idolatry. And we have the same theme in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 10:14. Flee from idolatry. 1 John 5:21, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Very important concept, because plenty of people who would not dream of bowing down before a stone image worship diamonds or other jewels. Plenty of people who'd never bow down to a wooden image will worship wood when it's built into a house. Plenty of people who'd never bow down to a metal image worship metal made into a car. An idol is anything that you put before God. It can be a hobby. It can be your spouse. It can be pleasure or your child or sports. But this is a tricky issue to come to terms with, and we each must individually come to terms with it. The story is told about an idol-burning ceremony in the backyard of a church house. They had talked about this together, and every member had torn from his heart his deepest desire, his dearest possession, the thing that was coming between him and God. And they took all these physical possessions and they heaped them up to burn all of their idols. But somehow nobody could find a match. Everybody agreed, though, that the failure to actually burn them didn't mean that they weren't willing to give them up. So they slowly drifted back to their homes with one or two backward glances at this pile of idols. One lady couldn't sleep very well that night. She finally convinced herself that what she had really given up was not an idol at all. So early the next morning, before the sun came up, she sneaked back to the pile, hoping not to be seen. And when she got there, she found that her lonely idol was the only one still left. Because we cling to those idols, whatever they are. What is it that you actually worship? Whatever you put your most disposable time, talent, and treasure to is likely the answer to that. When I ask, is there an idol in your life? What do you think of? Whatever you think of is probably it. Possessions, pride, people, objects, any of these can be idols. And then there is the issue of suffering in this chapter. When you have done wrong, you may have severe problems. But when you have done right, you may go through the severest trials of your life. There's something about this chapter that reminds me of the second chapter of 1 Peter. In 1 Peter 2, 19 and 20, we have this. This is thankworthy if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if, when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? But if, when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. Daniel 3 is an example of the very thing Peter was talking about there. In verse 1, we see that Nebuchadnezzar, the monarch of the Babylonian Empire, has made an image and issued a decree to worship it. The freedom of religion that we are experiencing at this time in the United States of America is unusual in the history of the world. Freedom of religion is granted along with four other freedoms by the First Amendment of our Constitution, indicating a separation between church and state. We have freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, and the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. But the usual situation throughout world history has been church-state religion, an established religion with compulsory involvement and mandatory worship by the population. In our own original 13 colonies, each one of them had an established religion that was given precedence and preference by the government of that colony. This has been the norm historically. Rulers used religion to support their government and to control their people. So in Babylon, as elsewhere, they wanted a single religion to unify the empire. This gold image, as Blake read, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits in breadth. It was based on the sexagesimal numerical system of the Babylonians, based on the number 6 and its multiples. You and I have a system that's based on the number 10. But they had one based on the number 6. They had a year with 360 days. And the fact that we now still have a circle with 360 degrees, the fact that we now still have a clock with 12 hours, we still have an hour with 60 minutes, we still have a minute with 60 seconds, that's all part of our Babylonian heritage carried down to us through the intervening civilizations. Whether this gold image was solid gold, or whether it was constructed of wood and then covered over with gold, I am unable to determine. But in either case, there was a great deal of gold there. Warren Buffett, who's very interested in money, a few years ago said that if all the known gold in the world was put together, melted down and put together, it would make a 68-foot cube, that is, height, width, and depth, 68 feet. Just think about that for a moment. That's not enormous. That would easily fit in the infield of a baseball diamond with lots of room to spare. Just a 68-foot cube. That's all the gold there is in the world, according to the Oracle of Omaha. I don't know how he knows it for sure, but I'm sure he gave it some thought. That's not a lot when you look at the whole world. And it gets reused, recycled, gets melted down and used for other things. Some of the gold you have right now on your fingers could have been on a palace in Babylon. It could have been in this very image that we're talking about in Daniel chapter 3. This image was enormous. I don't know if the pedestal was part of the 90 feet or just how that was. But Nebuchadnezzar had been down to Egypt. He may have seen enormous building projects there. Later on, we know that the Colossus of Rhodes was 105 feet tall, one of the seven wonders. So this is not out of line, 90 feet tall. The image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream in chapter 2 had a head of gold and then other metals representing other kingdoms to come succeeding him. But this one that he constructs in chapter 3 is all gold. It's all him. And I think it's likely that it had a face on it that was the face of Nebuchadnezzar, but I can't prove that. We do know that Nebuchadnezzar wanted glory for himself. Herod Agrippa was eaten of worms for that later on. Nebuchadnezzar gets his comeuppance in chapter 4. We're not given a year for this account, though the Septuagint says that this was in the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. If that's true, that would be 587 BC. Chapter 2 happened in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, so there may have been some significant time go by since chapter 2. And these boys that we saw back in chapter 1, if this much time has gone by, they're now probably men in their 30s. They've had a lot of experience. They have learned the ropes in this place where they are in Babylonian captivity. Bear in mind that Daniel made a tremendous interpretation of the dream with a lot of predictions about what was to come in the future in chapter 2, but none of that has come to pass yet. Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, is still in power. And so they can't rely on that as saying, well, the predictions that were made through the dream came true, and therefore we can have more confidence in God. They didn't have that. And yet they hold the line of their scruples. In verses 2 and 3, we see that everybody was supposed to bow down and worship this image, and nobody but the Hebrews would have any scruples about that. Other people were used to having lots of God, and one more didn't make any difference. But the Jews had the Shema from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. Hear, O Israel, Jehovah, your God, is one, and there are no other gods. So keep monotheism alive. That's the second commandment. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them. So there's a direct conflict here. The king says, worship the image. Jehovah says, no other gods. And you can't go both ways on that. You're going to go one way or the other. This is an interesting group of musical instruments here, an interesting band or orchestra. There were some stringed instruments there, some wind instruments. It's impossible at this point for us to determine with precision what these instruments all were, but we know there are wind and stringed. Seldom have gods been worshipped without music of some sort. I would very much like to have heard how this sounded, although I'm glad I wasn't there, but I would like to have heard how this sounded. Years ago, I was at a concert up in Iowa where no instrument on the stage was less than 400 years old. And it was a different sound than we would have from either a band or an orchestra in our time. So I would have liked to have heard this, but we don't even know what the instruments were. In the Babylonian Empire, punishment by burning was well known, and this is to enforce the uniformity of religion by the authority of the civil magistrates. And now here come the accusers. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't fall down, people come to the king, sidling up to him, and they accuse the Jews. And it's interesting to me that they call them Jews. In verse 8, they come, and in verse 12, there are certain Jews. Now, why didn't they just say there are certain men? That would have been true. That would have been right. But there are certain Jews. Anti-Semitism is nothing new. We're seeing some anti-Semitism now in our own time and country, as well as other countries around the world. It's an interesting thing how this crops up again and again. There seems to be some anti-Semitism here. There are certain Jews. Nebuchadnezzar wants to be fair, so he comes to these men and says, didn't you understand? Maybe you didn't get the memo, but I'm going to give you a second chance. And they say, don't bother. Don't bother to give us a second chance. The key to this chapter is in verses 16 through 18. We don't even need to give you an answer. It's not necessary for us to give you an answer. After all, you know who we are. You know where you took us from. You brought us here from our home where we worship the one true and living God. We don't need any defense. We don't owe you any explanation. Jehovah can save us, they say, and Jehovah will save us. But even if he doesn't, we're still going to serve him. It's interestingly put that Jehovah will deliver us. And that would have been true no matter what happened. Because if they die, they're still delivered from the king. They got clear away from him if they die. Serving God doesn't mean that things always turn out our way. Maybe it's God's plan to let you perish in the fire. That's perfectly possible. But the bottom line on this is that whether we live or die, we're not bowing to your image. And that's the final answer. In verse 19, it's possible when the face of the king changes that he is unwittingly revealing some of the psychotic tendencies that come full-blown in the next chapter when he loses his mind. Maybe he's already teetering on the brink of a breakdown because his facial expression is altered. It's interestingly put. In verses 19 through 24, the word bound is repeated several times. This was intended to be an involuntary cremation. Just burn them up, get rid of them, get rid of their influence. But in the fiery furnace, as is well known, there was a fourth personage seen, literally a son of the gods. Jehovah was nothing to these polytheistic people, but there was an angelic companion in that furnace with them. These men were divinely insulated as though they had been in a bubble. The message here is that God is in charge whether the result is triumph or tragedy. Sometimes, as in the case of Job, God chooses to take away. But it's still true that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. All things work together for good, but that doesn't mean all things are good. Our Father thinks too much of us to give us all things easy all the time. And he doesn't say all things work together so that we see them as good. He doesn't need to answer all our questions. Suffering is necessary whether it seems fair or unfair. But deliverance is impressive. Verse 21, verse 23, verse 24 talks about these men being bound, but in verse 25 they are loose. The only thing that burnt was the thing which bound them, the rope that they were tied together with. Sometimes God uses fire to burn off that which is binding us. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume, thy gold to refine. The dross or the slag rises and is skimmed away, and the gold is even purer than before. There are people in this room right now that could tell about suffering and the freedom they have enjoyed since that suffering. When you go through a furnace-type experience, you are watched by people both godly and ungodly. When God loosens things that used to bind you, It's impressive. You can become a sermon in shoes. In the 28th verse, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't say, blessed be these three men, but it's blessed be the God of these three men. Their actions reflected positively on their God. You don't get the glory. You become a mirror reflecting the glory of God. The hammer is a useful tool, but the nail, if it had feeling and intelligence, could present another side of the story. The nail knows the hammer as a brutal, merciless enemy who lives to pound it into submission, to beat it down out of sight and clinch it into place. That's the nail's only view of the hammer, and it's accurate except for one thing. The nail tends to forget that both it and the hammer are servants of the same workman. The carpenter decides whose head shall be beaten next and what hammer will be used in the beating. The file is more painful still. Its business is to bite into the soft metal, scraping and eating away the edges until it has shaped the metal to its own will. And yet the file has, in truth, no will of its own. It serves the same master as the metal does. It's the master who decides how much shall be eaten away and what shape the metal will take and how long the painful filing will continue. Let the metal accept the will of the master, and it won't try to dictate when or how it shall be filed. The furnace is the worst of all. Ruthless and savage, it leaps at every combustible thing that enters it. The furnace never relaxes its fury until it has reduced all to shapeless ashes. All that refuses to burn is melted into a mass of helpless matter. When everything is melted that will melt, when all is burned that will burn, then and not until then, the furnace calms down and rests from its destructive fury. It's easy to resent the hammer, the file, and the furnace. But God knows what he's about. Even Jesus learned obedience through the things which he suffered. Can you and I really expect anything different? Life is not a playground. Life is a battleground. We climb to higher ground and we move on. Like these three Jews, each of us needs to draw a line of conviction beneath which we will not descend. There's a battle between this internal principle and the external pressure that comes at us from all sides. We need to decide before the bow is drawn against us just what we will and will not do. It's not important that we see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in this chapter. It is important that we see ourselves in this chapter and that we see ourselves ahead of time deciding to stand firm, to stand strong, to draw that line of conviction and not descend beneath it. There was a letter written about his little son by a soldier from the trenches of France. I believe this happened in World War I. We sent a lot of American soldiers over there, and they had a rough time in those trenches in the First World War. This letter was sent home by the father of this little boy. It was written to his wife because the son was too young to read. Here's what he said. The first prayer I want my son to learn to pray for me is not, God, keep Daddy safe, but God, make Daddy brave, and if he has hard things to do, make him strong to do them. Life and death don't matter as much as right and wrong do. Daddy dead is Daddy still, but Daddy compromised is something too awful for words. And then he said, if you want to put in a little bit about safety at the end, put it in afterward, but it doesn't matter nearly as much. Stephen Girard was an unbelieving millionaire in Philadelphia years ago. One Saturday, he told his clerks that they had to come in the next day and unload a shipment that had just arrived. One young man stepped nervously up to the desk and said, Mr. Girard, I can't work on Sunday. Gerard said, "Well, if you can't do as I want, we can part company." The young man said, "I know that, sir, and I also know that I have a widowed mother to care for, but I can't work on Sunday." "Very well," Gerard said, "go to the cashier's desk and he'll settle up with you." 3 long weeks, that young man walked the streets looking for work to take care of his mother. And one day, a bank president opening a new branch of a bank asked Gerard if he knew of someone suitable to be in charge of the cashiers in it. Gerard named the very young man that he had just recently fired because, he said, "the man who will lose his job on account of principle is the man you can trust with your money." Draw that line of conviction and don't descend beneath it. We conclude this morning by once again extending the Lord's invitation. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego served the God that they professed to serve when push came to shove. Would you do the same? If you're outside of Jesus Christ today, do you believe him enough to step out in simple trusting faith and obey him by being immersed in water for the remission of your sins? If you have something else to bring before the assembled brethren, whether you need to publicly confess a public sin or to ask for the prayers of the church, any other appropriate request we will consider if you'll come to the front as we stand together, sing one more song. Peter?